Hi there. You're listening to Sample Space. You may have used tools like GitHub Copilot, or maybe even Cursor, where you're able to plug in an LLM to help you code in your IDE. However, as you're using these tools, you've probably also noticed that it is kind of like a vendor lock-in. If you want to make some small changes, it can be hard to tune the LLM workflow in a way that suits you best. And that's where a little project called continue.dev might actually make a bit of a difference. In this episode, I'm talking to the co-founder, Ty Dunn, who happens to be a former colleague of mine, and we're talking about how continue.dev got created, but also how people should really start rethinking their tools themselves more. Using continue.dev, you're actually able to generate your own training data as you're developing, which also gives you the flexibility and freedom to customize your own workflow. It's a pretty inspiring project, and there's lots of little anecdotes that we also learn about in this episode, so I hope you'll enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Hi, Ty.
Hey, Vincent. It's good to see you.
Yeah. So for the listeners, Ty and I are ex-colleagues, which is also partially why you're going to hear this very informal conversation. But what we're here to talk about today is Ty's new project, continue.dev, I think is the easiest way to find out about it. But before talking about what continue.dev does exactly, like we had a call before where we also talked about like how frustrations can sometimes lead you towards a great project. And it feels like that's kind of the story of what happened here eventually. So what I would like to do is maybe start all the way at the beginning before you joined Raza, and then we can talk about how we met and then what you did after. Because I think part of that helps explain how continue.dev got to be where it is right now. So maybe as a place to start. Right after college, you started doing stuff with chatbots, right? If I recall correctly?
Correct. Even during university, I always prefer the term conversational interface. But yes, chatbots are something I got into. I really wanted to be able to express in natural language or enable people to express in words what they wanted or what they were trying to do and have software that was capable of following through on those actions or helping them achieve that. And so I got really interested in natural language processing, machine learning at university.
And what year was this? Like what era of machine learning was this maybe?
Been 2015, not too long after a lot of the real excitement around neural networks was beginning to build, largely stayed.
Like, what about it? What about the conversational bit got you so interested? Because, you know, I'm sure it wasn't just a science fiction movie, but there is an interest. Like, was there something about being able to have a conversation with the system and then steer it? Something about that was the most interesting thing to you? Because you started early on this one.
I had got an internship by asking a billionaire to borrow his helicopter in high school when I was 17. Mm-hmm. And I sent a letter to his house and he was like, hey, we don't own or operate a helicopter, but you should come work for us. And so I worked at his company, and the company had like 30,000 employees and like 30-year-old software. And my job there was just to figure out, like, it was a loan company, mortgage company. And my job was to figure out, like, how come mortgages sometimes would take 600 days to get through process? And kind of through that experience, I got to see the inner workings of this organization. And I saw how basically it was a web form on the internet. And then a lot of software in the background, a lot of people in the background making it happen. And so I just realized, wow, like what you can build with software can really scale, but then also there are ways in which software is quite limiting, right? We needed so many people doing repetitive things. We needed quite a bit of lift to get just a web form that collected information and helped you get a loan application. So I really wanted kind of a future where we didn't have to have that, right? Where in your own words, you could explain what you want and the software would just go and do it.
There's two things interesting about this. So one is I can't imagine that on a very young age, you're not taught how software is supposed to work, but very young, you come in there, you kind of go, well, obviously this is not how it's supposed to work. Like something about being very young, if you realize that, I think, because I can imagine a few years of like web dev in college or something, and you get in your mind, no, actually, this is how it's supposed to work because I was taught it this way. Like granting yourself an intellectual freedom when you're young, I think is definitely helpful there. But I got to ask, like you send a billionaire a letter, what happened there? Like what's the story?
Yeah. So I was in high school and I went to a really large high school in Michigan in the United States. And I wanted to go to the prom, which was an hour away. And usually what people would do is people would get a party bus with their friends. In my case, I was like, oh, it'd be pretty funny if I got a helicopter instead, but I couldn't pay for a helicopter. My parents wouldn't. So I found the four billionaires that live in the Detroit area and I just found their home addresses and I mailed them and I asked, can I borrow your helicopter for an evening? And never got the helicopter, but I did get an internship accidentally.
Oh, that is I do remember that prom moment when I was 17, and I would be like a badass if I showed up on a tractor or something, but this is going next level, I take it.
I will say, like, good on you for trying, though, because I do believe that there's a lot of these, like, magic moments that simply don't happen because people don't dare ask the question in a way. But in this particular case, even though you didn't get the helicopter, I do think it's very valuable to, on a very young age, look at the world and be able to say, like, well, obviously, this is not going to be it. And just having that vivid memory in there. Because that's something I think in this particular case you kept carrying with you.
Exactly. Pretty much everything I've done since then is like asking why not, right? And often believing that the worst answer you're going to get is no, so why not ask, right? Because I know it's not that bad. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, right, if you ask enough times, right, maybe you ask 100 times and you get a yes only on the 100th time after 99 no's. But usually with a lot of things in life, you just need one yes. You don't need...
You still get a yes.
That many yes.
I think in Japan, they have the saying, like, you plant 1,000 seeds and some of them will be a lotus, kind of like that?
That's about right.
Okay, but then, okay. But if you got some inherent motivation, like, then you go to college, and what did you study?
Cognitive science, with a focus in computation. So it's like intersection of computer science with philosophy, psychology, linguistics, neuroscience.
And what got you into that initially?
I didn't want to study just computer science because I felt like, I think like when you, whatever you study in university, I think there's some knowledge you learn, but I think more importantly, it teaches you how to think, right? And I didn't want to interact in the world in a purely computer science way. As much as I enjoy data structures and algorithms, I didn't like doing that all day, every day. I enjoyed being able to kind of study many things, and cognitive science with my computation focus allowed me to take all the computer science classes I wanted, but then I could then explore psychology and philosophy and linguistics and neuroscience and kind of round it out. And, at the time I was really interested in, like, how does the human mind work? And could we actually build something that is mind-like in silicon? And cognitive science kind of offered the opportunity to learn the technical skills, but then also the maybe other subjects so that I could get a better, more vivid picture. And at that time, artificial intelligence was, I thought, hyped and was cool. In hindsight, it doesn't seem like it was much of a hype wave compared to the current one. But at the time, it was pretty big, at least in my friend circles and in the places on the internet that I existed. And so those things kind of combined and helping me think about what I wanted to do after university or what I wanted to even do at university. They inform.
That makes sense. I mean, I can definitely imagine looking back, it's definitely nice to have not just like the tool school, but also the application side of it, if that makes sense. Like computer science in the end, a lot of what you're doing is you're building tools, but if you're not exposed to like an actual problem where you have to solve something, right? And there's something you might miss. So that definitely feels sensible. But then you did pick up, I guess, some NLP courses. That was a thing you ended up doing, or?
Yeah, I ended up really focusing on the intersection of language and computation and computational linguistics. So I studied with a professor at Michigan named Stephen Abney. I did a number of his kind of computational NLP courses, and then I ended up doing an independent study with him. And so he really brought me through kind of the good old fashioned AI GoFi approaches. So we built syntax trees and built an automated reasoner that could tell you that Socrates knew he was mortal by deduction, right? And it was very bad, right? But it kind of gave me that grounding. And then towards the end, started to do neural network, deep learning kind of courses and kind of bring in originally just vanilla neural networks and then recurrent neural networks and other techniques for kind of learning about natural language processing.
Yeah. And then you get into like the classifiers, the named entity recognition, like those kinds of tools come around. Okay. So you've done your college thing. You've got a pretty good background. Luckily, you've not done only computer science. You're also aware of like language and things. But I guess the next best step is either you go do what everyone wants to do, which is join a FANG, or you do something where you actually apply the thing you actually learned, but you actually try to do applied NLP in a way. Like that, I think, was that in your mind as well? Am I guessing?
Yeah, exactly. I actually had worked at a startup while at university who was applying kind of deep learning for natural language understanding. Mm-hmm. It was called Clink. We were building conversational AI for kind of more of the banking world. And I was on the AI R&D team. I worked on their dialogue management system. And the kind of way they were doing dialogue management at the time was more of a state machine. And it became clear to me kind of through that experience, right? Being able to see natural language understanding, NLU, done with recurrent neural networks to classify intents and extract entities, that like, how come we weren't doing something similar in the dialogue management space? How come you had two modules, right, an NLU and dialogue management that they weren't merged into an end-to-end system. And so started to just really dive into the literature in the dialogue management space and found Raza, where we ultimately ended up working together, as you'll hear, and decided to kind of join that team because they had a real thesis around learning from conversations or from conversation-like things on the dialogue management side. And I found that quite compelling.
So this is I think this is a point in time where a small deep dive might be nice, because what I remember from joining Raza, I think I met you on like day one, where there's this speech that the CTO gave, and it's kind of along the lines of, well, if you're going to be building bots here, like, here's how not to do it. Then I figured, okay, I got the how not to do it speech, and then I met you, and then I really got the not how to do it speech.
Something like, you were very, very frustrated with like one way of thinking about dialogue management systems. And I think frustration in general is interesting, because inspiration can kind of come from there. So Tyler, like, what was wrong with how people sometimes thought about these dialogue systems? Like, what was your frustration there? Because I think it could be interesting.
Yeah, like, just given my background in language and computation, like, I just knew how generative language was and how many different ways there are to explain things and how there's just a long tail of ways people ask questions and state things. Like, I think, I don't know the exact number, but there's still a large percentage, I think, of Google queries that have only ever been asked by that particular person once. And so it's really easy to kind of cover the beginning of the distribution, but the long tail is quite hard when you're attempting to kind of think of every possible conversation state you might end up in and build, people use terms like flow graph or state machine to model and map that. And so in the research, right, people were kind of starting to apply neural networks and reinforcement learning and kind of explore that. But in industry at the time, it was just a kind of a state machine in the background. And then there was so much hype, or I thought there was so much hype about AI, about how it was going to revolutionize everything. And then you kind of get into these AI assistants, these chatbots, and you kind of realize like how brittle they actually are in the dialogue management, or at the time how brittle they were in dialogue management. So that really frustrated me, right? That we had been basically doing the same thing for 10 or 20 years there.
What was the main, do you have a clear example of what was brittle? Like, I remember back when we were at Raza, there would be this example of, hey, would you like to have sushi? And someone would reply by saying, no, I had that yesterday, without saying no. And then you had to figure out that that meant no.
Yeah.
But if you ask for a clear example of no, I had that yesterday, is not an example of saying no. So there's this immediate like, oh, wait, the classifiers aren't enough kind of a vibe. Like, but what you're talking about is slightly different, I think, right? Because like, your thorn there was state machines in particular.
Yeah, I think it's tied to what you're describing, right? Like, if you break the problem down as like, first the step needs to be NLU, and then the step needs to be dialogue management, then you're exactly right. That's only a classification problem of the intent, or I guess the denial.
Okay.
One that always kind of stands out for me, maybe it's also too simplistic, is the weather, because it's always the go-to like bot one that people do, or that like there's a nice free weather API, so it's the tutorial. But it's like the ability to be like, how's the weather today in San Francisco, right? And then the answers, and then you go, what about Berlin, right? And then it doesn't understand, right, that you're asking about the weather again because you didn't explicitly mention the weather, right? So you're kind of using this one-shot system where it goes NLU and then dialogue management, right? What about Berlin doesn't mention the weather, right, in order to understand that, you need that to be able to go back in the previous conversation history. And usually conversations reference things way further back in the conversation. Usually conversations reference things outside or in past conversations, and all of that kind of pulling in the relevant context at that right point of time, which I don't think we've fixed at all with large language models, is still like really tricky, right? Able to, yeah, to know what is relevant is hard for humans and more difficult for our systems.
It's funny you mentioned this. So the previous company I worked at, Explosion, Matt, the CTO, his test for how good is a bot is basically, can I refer to something I said before? Like, that's kind of the gold standard. We're not there yet. That's to all the listeners, if you want to break a bot online, say something and refer back to it like two steps in the conversation later. That is still a super hard problem for people to really, really get right.
Makes sense. So you're at Raza. You were there for like 3 years or so?
Yeah,
maybe
three, around 4 years.
Yeah, something like that. So you were there, I guess, in the era where there was a little hype, I think. Like Facebook in 2016 announced that they might allow for bots on their platform and their messenger, and that spurred a bunch of quote-unquote innovation and investment interest, yeah. I think. But then at some point, you know, I leave Raza, you left Raza, and then you got to kind of find something else to do. And I think he took a while to sort of figure out what you wanted to do next.
Part of me wonders, like, what made you, because LLMs came out around that time, was there a reason why you didn't really immediately dive back at the chatbots again? Because it felt like it was kind of your passion in a way. Or were you just kind of done with the field for a bit and kind of maybe looking for something new as well?
Yeah, we had this threat of large language models going on, right? And I was actually quite excited about that. So when we were at Raza when I first joined, right, GPT-2 came out and I remember playing with it in the staged release because they thought it was going to be problematic to release it all at once. So you got like progressively larger versions of it. And then I remember when GPT-3 came out, I remember your blog post, Vincent, that you wrote cautioning people around using it and just was playing with those, right? I got early access to Codex and was playing with that. And I thought there's a lot of potential for these tools to be general text manipulation tools and maybe more depending on how the research progressed. But prior to the invention of RLHF and some of the other related techniques, it was really hard to use these models to do anything. It was really hard to put them into any kind of production application. And so at the time, right, it wasn't 100% obvious that we were going to figure out how to do something like RLHF. And so when I left Raza, we were kind of in the GPT-3 era, but pre-ChatGPT era. And what I had kind of learned from working in conversational AI was that like, it's really hard to have a measure of success when it comes to conversations, right? So if you can get the user to maybe give a thumbs up or thumbs down at the end of the conversation, but it's hard to tell whether that thumbs up or thumbs down was because it was a well-handled conversation by the agent or if they were just happy or sad or angry at the end of the conversation and they were giving a thumbs up, thumbs down because they did or didn't what they wanted from the customer support AI assistant. And so it's hard to know like if a conversation was successful and even at the steps if you took the right action. And then in addition to that, like there's no like easy way for the people who are building these systems to leverage signals or annotate the data without having to do a lot of work, right? And what I realized is if you're going to be kind of building tools for people to use these, use your framework or use your AI code assistant in our case now, right? Like you have to enable them to make it better without having to do a ton of work. Because if you ask them to do a bunch of additional work beyond their current job scope, it's probably not something they're going to be able to do. Everyone's busy and doesn't have time to do their job and then go back and annotate the work that they did, right? And so that kind of, those two insights of first needing like clear measures of success or better signals of success, as well as finding ways for allowing people to basically do a kind of annotation or give signal in the course of their work, were kind of two aspects of whatever I did next that I wanted to make sure that those were there, because if we were going to build successful machine learning systems, I think those need to be present because you need to be able to use.
I'm going to, in my mind, it kind of sounds like as I'm using the tool, I should be able to improve it, kind of like
exactly.
That as a feeling. Yeah. And I do remember like when I interact with some chatbots, like when you work in chatbot land for a bit and then you actually interact with a chatbot, you just wish you would be able to sort of flag it to developers like this part of the conversation, it's here, this bit, it's this that's broken, this bit, please. That's not the UI usually, of course, but the thing of making dev tools that you can actually make it part of the UI. Like I think that's also kind of the realization. Like if you make a chatbot for yourself, that's also a little bit different. Like you can customize and you can tune it and you can really make it for you in a way. Like that's also kind of what I'm hearing.
Yeah, exactly, right? Where then you are the person both getting the suggestion or getting the answer, right? And the person who's deciding whether to use it or not. And then also the person who has the opportunity to help improve it so that you get a better suggestion in the future.
And then, so I'm imagining, I mean, you've also taken a bit of time off, I think. Like, I'm sure you also went on a small holiday, you spent some time with family and friends and stuff. But as all of that stuff is happening, you are thinking like, okay, like I know an arrow of a direction. But at some point you can put a flag in the sand and say like, okay, but this is a milestone. I now know what I'm going to be building. You've done your exploring thing, but at some point you kind of know, no, it's DevTools actually where I'm going to go. Because at some point you kind of have that nailed down, I guess. Like what was the thing for you that made you think like, okay, I know the direction, but eventually I'm going to have this thing called continue.dev? Like what was the main thing that caused you to go to?
Yeah, so I was just running on side projects with my now co-founder and we were doing anything and everything that sounded exciting, right? Sometimes that would be a couple of days, sometimes a couple of weeks, sometimes a couple of months working on a project. But every single time we would think,
this will be like a,
a buddy from college or ex-colleague?
Yeah, someone who went to my high school. His name's Nate. And we didn't know each other, though. He's 4 years younger than me. And so he grew up 10 minutes, but I didn't meet him until I was in Berlin. He was in Boston, and someone introduced us, friends with both of us, and we didn't know each other.
You met him at a random meetup kind of a situation, I suppose.
Yeah, like a bit of both, right? It's like almost like a deep shared history, right? Because we had a lot of the same experiences having grown up in the same hometown and both running like cross country and track and having many of the same teachers and things like that. But then you're exactly right. For a long time, like it was like only internet friends, or it felt like internet friends because we never met in person. Right? We just were working on side projects. So it was a weird mix of both someone very personal, but then very kind of
interesting. Okay, now meeting the right co-founder is not standard stuff. Like you got to get a little bit lucky there. But I can't imagine that if it's already established, you're from the same place and you got the same hobbies. I mean, there's a personal connection there. Oh, and you're interested in building the same thing. That does make it easier because you get more of a feeling, okay, I kind of know this person already because we have a shared history.
Exactly. Right. And so it made it easy to like just first do side projects together. And then we did that for, I think, okay, I don't know, 18 months. And we met at first once a week and eventually every single day. And he showed up every single time. I think I showed up every single time except for once when I was late. And so to have that amount of commitment to a side project, it showed me that like, oh, like maybe we could actually do something more significant than just side projects together.
Yeah. And I can also, it comes from both sides, I guess. Like at some point in your mind, you're going like, is this for real? And then the other party is also kind of going like, is this for real? And at some point you kind of go, well, we've been doing this for a year and a half. I guess it is. Okay. It's confirmed. Let's do this thing for real. Kind of.
Exactly. And now I actually thought it was maybe part of some elaborate catfishing scheme. So he was in Cambridge. And so I ended up flying to Cambridge in Massachusetts in the US and like hanging out. And we worked together in person for a few days. This was like as we were getting closer to maybe turning our side project into a company. I was like, I got to make sure to like meet him in person once before committing to starting a company.
Yeah. Now it might be a good time to start talking about like the how Continue to Dev got started thing, because we're going to revolve the conversation around that now. So what was like the first maybe version or first sort of thing you built that eventually became Continue to Dev? Like what was the first demo you eventually found yourself in?
Yeah, tying in the part of the last question I didn't answer too, right? Like we had, as we were doing those side projects, right, we were using GitHub Copilot more and more. We were using the original Codex model, the DaVinci GPT-3 model, kind of playing around with those to help us as we were building software, and they were awesome, but it was pretty obvious from just even like a little bit of usage of like how much better they could be. So time, like a simple thing like, oh, it suggests I knew it use a library at this point. Like, why don't you just also import the library? Things like that were not being done when they were given suggestions, but felt obvious. And so that, you know, I mean, frustration you were talking about, the real fundamental frustration that led to the creation of Continue is like, when I get a suggestion that I feel is bad or wrong, I should be able to do something about it. And that isn't possible with kind of many of the kind of what I call the black box AI code assistants, where you don't understand how a suggestion was made, why it came to that suggestion. And then as a result, you can't figure out how to change it or make it better in the future. And so we had started to just work on using LLMs in the coding process as our next side project at kind of fall of 2022. And so we did everything from like helping you debug stack traces to generate unit tests to reviewing PRs to could we build some kind of, I don't know if we would have used the term at the time, like agentic workflow, right? Or async completing LLM. And we just kept iterating on all of those and just tried to like give them to friends to play with. And most of them people would not play with. And then we got to eventually a VS Code extension that allowed you to not have to copy paste back and forth between ChatGPT and your IDE, which we didn't have to change anybody's behavior, right? Like they wanted it closer to where they came from.
It sends you an alt tap to and an alt tap back. That's already
exactly. They wanted to avoid that. And so that was kind of version was kind of a very simple way of pulling in LLM as an extension inside of VS Code.
So there's a few things I think that are interesting here, because I can imagine, right, for a lot of people that are first interacting with, let's say, a Copilot, and it might have been a different thing, but let's say it's Copilot, and they kind of go, oh, okay, it's generating code for me, super awesome. Oh, it didn't do the import right. Oh, you know what? I'll just do that. But something about that was very frustrating to you. It's also something I'm kind of hearing. I'm just kind of curious, what was it about like those little things that were wrong that made you kind of go, oh, no, 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 no? Like, was this a chatbot thing again, or was it something else? Or like, how would you describe that? Because that is an important moment, right? in order for continued adapt to have existed, you need to have that frustration.
Yeah, I think it ties to the conversation I had to chatbots as well. I don't know. The basic frustration is like, if we have systems that are going to automate things for us, right? Like, I don't know if you ever heard this phrase, like the machine decision is final, right? Like, I don't want to live in a world where the machine decision is final, right? And so if I'm going to be heavily using kind of a machine learning system to either do my job or to get help interacting with an organization, I want to be able to, if that machine decision I think is wrong, I mean, ideally appeal it, but in the best case scenario, go and fix it myself, right? And so, and if we're going to be building developer tools, developers are more than capable of doing that themselves. Or I was really, it started off as building a tool for myself, building it with my co-founder, us building a tool for ourselves. It's been at the very heart, still remains at the heart of Continue. It's like all of our team, including us, use Continue as we build software, as we code. We eat our own pizza. We're not people who eat dog food. Dog fooding, we're pizza makers who eat our own pizza. And yeah, I mean, that far.
What's the distinction between dog fooding and pizza eating? And like, I gotta ask, is this like a inside joke in Silicon Valley kind of a thing? Like, you do pizza these days instead of dog food?
I don't know where it came from. I think it might have actually came from, it might have been Docker. I would have to like track it down. But someone who worked at Docker or Cloudera or something like that also had this observation. I don't think it's my original observation that like, at companies we always say like, we need to dog food our product, right? But like, as an eat our own dog food, but humans don't eat dog food, or I guess generally humans don't eat dog food. So okay. What would be something more appealing?
Pizza. The lingo has upgraded, is what I'm hearing in that sense. Okay, that's good. But then, okay, so the I think there's two interesting observations. Like one, frustration can be a good thing, but it's also kind of precious. Like if you didn't like fully go down deep in the frustration, like this idea might not have really sparked. But another thing I also think is kind of interesting is where a lot of machine learning people these days, they kind of go, oh, machine learning problem, throw more tensors at it. That's also not what you've done. You've actually taken the UI approach a bit more, which I think is also interesting because I can imagine to a lot of machine learning people that doesn't come naturally in a way.
Yeah.
Like, I'm kind of curious, like to me, it's very sensible, right? Like UI is super duper important. I wish more people would kind of do it. But was it just because you just looked at it and think like, oh God, UI just got to be better. This is the obvious first thing. Or was it also maybe the easiest thing? Like what made you dive into the UI first, I suppose?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of a systems thinker, so I think about the entire system, right? And my preference is almost always to work on problems where, I mean, this is why I've always enjoyed the machine learning kind of world. Like, I don't know, Twitter back in the day had like a great ML Twitter community that would be constantly sharing and the archive community around sharing papers. And there's a lot of like kind of building on each other's work And I find myself gravitating towards areas there where it's like, I think there's just often, right? And the AI code assistant space is a good example of this now, right? Where everybody's basically building the same thing, but they're not working together. They haven't found a way to work on a part of it that can be complementary to much of the other work. And so I'm really like, there was OpenAI and there was, I think Anthropic had started by that point. And there was quite a bit of research going on how to make the models better, how to better crawl the internet for data. There was lots of compute being created by NVIDIA. And so a lot of the other aspects of kind of the problem felt like people were addressing them, but the one that didn't feel like it was addressed yet was kind of this interface, right? Like what would the UI UX look like? So there's a part of it. The other part is like, I didn't have a lot of money. My co-founder was in university, didn't have a lot of money. So like, as much as we maybe would have wanted to train models, right? That wasn't the most accessible. And so the area where we felt like we could help kind of the entire ecosystem was at the interface level. And then also got kind of given constraints, it was also the best place for us to get started.
What I think is kind of interesting there is by diving into the UI a bit more, I think you can also give yourself just a little bit more freedom to reimagine things, if that makes sense. Because saying what you will, throwing more tensors at it is not necessarily going to be original. Like you might get better scores or something, but it also kind of feels like a constrained way to sort of experience the problem in a bit. Let's talk about some of the UI changes you've kind of made. I think you first made them for VS Code, and nowadays you also make them for the PyCharm.
IntelliJ, WebStorm, GoLand.
So this is a podcast, so we're not going to be able to like actually show people, but maybe just to give a bit of a description, like what are things you can do now with Continue from a UI perspective that you weren't able to do before? Just to maybe mention a few ideas and features.
Yeah, so like when we originally got started, right, ChatGPT was the way that you would copy paste or that you would use kind of these what we call chat models that are kind of these large 123 billion plus parameter models I use that because Mistral Large 2 is quite good and 123. So you could probably get them smaller, but today, like the ones that make for good chat models are at least that big. And you would have to copy and paste back and forth between Google Chrome or Arc or Safari and your text
browser.
So the original one was just to bring in that experience. But given my background in chatbots, we didn't kind of take the approach that a lot of other people take of like put the AI, like have it respond as an AI assistant and then anthropomorphize the response and have it be back and forth. Like I have always kind of viewed these large language models as general text manipulation tools. So even today when you use Continue, we call it chat just because that's the word that almost everyone is familiar with. They've come across ChatGPT. And so to be able to reuse a lot of that mental infrastructure is and intuitions and understanding is helpful. But like there's no like chatbot that responds. Instead, you ask your query or give your instruction. And then below it, there's an attempt to do or do that instruction or answer that question, but it's not presented to you as like AI assistants responding with this. It's more of like,
you're working. Yeah, so it's not like a hello, Billy, I would do this.
Exactly. It's almost like talking to yourself. And then the language model kind of ideally extending your thinking or doing the piece that you're not doing manually.
And then it would basically, I've used it a bunch of moments and you kind of get like a diff kind of a feeling comes to mind there a little bit. Like, hey, here, focusing on the changes that we'll be interested in making. And then you can sort of pick up the ball from there. That's kind of the experience.
Yeah. So in other cases, like you're talking kind of about like the edit affordance where you can highlight some code and you can say, I want it to transform it in some arbitrary way, right? Maybe you want to make the variables human readable. Maybe you want it to be commented for you. Maybe you want to optimize it in some kind of way. And so you give that instruction and then it presents that diff where it's like, here's the original, here's the new one. And so you kind of have the chat, the edit, and then lastly is autocomplete, which I think people are more familiar with or most familiar with.
But just tapping, right?
Exactly. And so ghost text shows up and you tap to accept or you don't accept by just continuing to type manually.
Yeah. Okay. But so what I'm hearing here then is that there's also like, there is some distinction. It's not the sense that, oh, we've got one LLM for one task. Like I think you're describing three tasks already that are somewhat distinct in your IDE, right? So like the tapping, you can kind of say, well, that could be one LLM, but you could also have a separate system for that. There's a chat experience, and there could be sort of a separate system for that. So given like a somewhat distinct UI, you could also start rethinking about these models in a way, because there's different tasks in an IDE that you can use an LLM for, I think is the next logical step for you.
Exactly. And it's often the case that it's not even necessarily like, oh, you need a single model per task, but the different parts of the task or the affordance as I tend to call it, require different models. So a good example would be like when you're in chat, right? You're chatting with one of probably the more frontier models, the largest models that have been created, have the most up-to-date knowledge and ability to help you.
And we like the Anthropics of the world and the OpenAIs of these worlds, like those kinds of big boys.
Yeah. Or even the Metas, right? If you want to do an open source or Mistral, you want to do an open source internal deployment. And so you're kind of having the chat and you get to like a code section that you want, and then you want to apply it to the editor, actually put it into the code. There's a button where you can hit apply and it instantly takes the code and figures out the diff that needs to be inserted and inserts that diff. And that is a different model, right? So like the chat model is different than the apply model. And the reason is because like the chat models aren't very good at, they haven't been trained on a lot of diffs, right? And they aren't good at generating diffs. Mm-hmm. Right? You can actually get a much smaller model that's much better at producing the diffs that you need in order to apply that code to the text file. And in addition, like not only is it better, but smaller and cheaper and faster, right?
I was about to say, like a specialized, right? So you can get all the benefits
exactly.
from it.
And so almost all of these tasks, right? I gave a presentation at the Databricks Mountain View office yesterday. And as part of preparing for that, I'm like, what is the most like number of models that I've seen that are specialized in the system? And I think 8 is roughly the number, but generally you don't have to use that many different models. But I think that is the number of models we've already started to see. And you know, I mean, this is probably double of what I would have said last year. I'd probably say 4 last year, right? And so in a year, we've got
that
up
was
to
interesting.
8, right? And so I have a feeling this trend is going to continue, that you're going to need more specialized, you're going to really benefit from having more specialized models for different aspects of the task. And that as a result, like, the system will give better suggestions, and then also you'll not have to spend so much money running really large models that are unnecessary for a particular task.
And when you say specialized models, I'm kind of curious, would that be maybe specializing on a specific language? I can imagine that. Or is it a specific kind of edits? Like what will make these models very distinct then in a way? Because eight sounds like a lot. I would not have expected that.
Yeah, maybe as we're talking and I can talk through the different eight just to kind of give, I think that's the best way to kind of explain. So there's like the chat model, right, that you're talking to that we've talked a little bit better, like generally like 123 billion plus. Then you have the autocomplete model. Those models need to balance not just quality of suggestion, but latency, because they're giving you suggestions as you type, which is okay if the chat model starts like giving you a response, you can, it can output more tokens a second than you can read per second. And so that's great. But for autocomplete, it needs to be completely there right when you're typing and you can type pretty fast. And so generally those models are between 1 and 22 billion parameters. They've also been trained for a different objective than the chat model of fill in the middle. So that's capable of doing it. So that's like a really clear example of like chat versus autocomplete. So you have those two models, and then the edit model can be different. Often people just reuse the chat because like setting up eight models is
quite a bit of work
and quite the setup
and doing it all.
And so often that's the same as a chat model, but the edit model could be different. And we have seen people who use a different one. And maybe they just find that like, oh, they really enjoy Claude Sonnet 3.5 for, or maybe GPT-4o, right, for the conversation, for the chat experience. But then for the edit, Claude Sonnet 3.5 is much better at creating short snippets of code that are a transformation of the previous code that was there. Then you have the apply model, which we talked about a little bit. This next model, what kind of calling it an orchestration model, where what we do is it just like selects files from a list given a query, right? And you don't need a giant model for that. So often like if you're using Anthropic's Claude Sonnet 3.5, you can just use like Haiku, their small model, for kind of that task. And it's cheaper, it's faster, and does as good of a job as kind of the larger Anthropic model. Then you have the embeddings and re-ranking models. Those are used in kind of building RAG systems over code, RAG systems over documentation, RAG system over software development lifecycle. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4 hops.
So those tasks would kind of be like, hey, could you explain what this code over here does? And sometimes it needs to refer to other bits of the code. And for that, you need some embeddings. Is that maybe
exactly?
In
so then continue the way that the affordance works is you type the at symbol and then code base. And then that then calls the RAG system to try and find relevant parts of the code base that might be good context. Or the one I really use it for at Codebase is great, but I really like the docs where if I'm working in, say, I'm building something in React, and I haven't used React for a while, right? I can add the React docs, and then instead of having to like go through there myself, it will go and find the relevant parts of the docs and give that as context to help the model answer. And then also it gives you hyperlinks. And so if like the answer doesn't seem quite right, or I want to read more, I can click, and then it goes and shows me the part of the docs it pulled this information from, which is super helpful for as I'm coding.
You still get the source if you need be. And then also, if you don't trust the answer, you can actually verify that it's correct. And there's all sorts of little benefits in doing it that way.
But okay. Yeah. So what you're saying here is pretty interesting. Part of my mind is thinking like, oh yeah, there's a lot of stuff that you can do in an IDE that becomes unconscious at some point. Like sometimes you can kind of take it for granted. But for a lot of stuff that you would normally do with an IDE, if you want to use an LLM to make it better, at some point for all of those little things you might want to do, it can make sense to have a specific model for it. If only to keep things lightweight, and also because you want to be able to customize it, I guess. That's also like a theme I'm kind of
exactly using. Right. If you're using smaller models, more specialized models, right, then what you were saying earlier, like, yeah, you could specialize it for the programming language. We have some friends that are working on trying to figure out, can you make an autocomplete model for Go, right? Could you actually do something better there if you just focus on a particular programming language? In other cases, it could be other kind of dimensions of making it specialized, but there's a lot of value in keeping the models small so that you can find and you can continue to pre-train or maybe even train those models from scratch in the longer term.
I'm curious what your impression is on this one, because it's kind of a throwback to Raza. Because back when I worked there, one theme I kept sort of hitting my head against was, oh, we've got all these pre-trained models and they work amazing for English. Oh boy, golly, we've got good embeddings for English. And then you go for Dutch. Oh, we've got okay embeddings and stuff in NLP for Dutch, but then we get some users from, I don't know, Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, like all sorts of places. And then at some point, you also got to admit, gee, like the world of pre-trained NLP models, especially back then, it is overfitting on English. And I'm kind of wondering, when we talk about like these LLMs for programming languages, I can imagine a similar thing is happening. Whenever I interact with some of these tools, I notice that it's really good at JavaScript and Python.
But then you go to Rust, the behavior can be a bit spotty if not careful. Is this a fair characterization? Is this something you also notice?
Definitely. It's something that I've been pretty concerned about for a long time. I mean, in, I guess, the entirety of Continue's existence, and something I dug into last year, I wrote a blog post, and the way that I tried to estimate like how good are LLMs, is if you look at human eval, which is like when a new model drops, there's this benchmark called human eval that everyone uses to say how good their model is at coding. Like if you go read that paper and look at that benchmark, it's 164 Python problems is apparently how we estimate how good like a model is at coding, right? And so it's like, well, that doesn't seem like it's telling us that much about anything beyond Python, right? And those situations are not very representative of like how coding is actually done. And so I went and dug into, I looked at of the models that share kind of their training data composition, like the different percentages of programming languages. I went and looked, okay, if these models or if these people are scraping, if these labs are scraping the internet, right? Like Stack Overflow and GitHub are probably two of the largest repositories of code or code related data. And so what is the relative approximate amount of Go and C and JavaScript on those sites? And then like, what are the kind of anecdotes from developers? And so I went through every particular programming language's subreddit and just searched LLMs or ChatGPT or GitHub Copilot and tried to just learn from the experiences of people using those. And what I found is exactly what you're describing, right? Where TypeScript and JavaScript, everyone's super excited. And then you go to things like Assembly and Verilog and
Durant. Correct in observing that it's kind of the compiled languages then? Is that also maybe fair? Like a little bit more the compiled corner of the world?
Yeah, that's a good question. No, I haven't got enough to be able to be like, is this... Because there's also the question of like, does knowing one programming or does having data about one programming language help you to be better at another programming language? Like intuitively, that feels like that's the case, that like something like JavaScript, right? Knowing that would really help you with TypeScript, or knowing TypeScript or having that data would probably really help you. But it's like, I think it's probably more like how similar is the data or how similar is the programming language to the ones that are going to be most represented in the training data sets would probably be my rough intuition on.
Yeah, so if I wanted to do k-means in Python, well, we've got scikit-learn, and that's like fully solved. They go, hey, how do I do k-means in TypeScript? Well, then it might need to be written from scratch, actually, because it might not be a good machine learning library. And then, I don't know.
Yeah, or maybe it gives you a suggestion, right? Like how you would do it, right? Or if you were doing it in TypeScript, you'd probably bring a lot of like your knowledge about how to kind of do it in a Pythonic way in TypeScript, right? So I imagine like some of the suggestions we get that are strange are as a result of that as well.
Interesting. Yeah, no, that makes sense. No, this is also another throwback, because I remember talking to one of the researchers back at Raza, and she was teaching me like the hard part of translation, like NLP translation is also like a thing. But how, like, suppose you've got a poem in one language that rhymes. How on earth are you going to translate that into another language such that it also rhymes? Like, there's so many of these like weird little edge cases. But you got that in programming languages too. Like, hey, take this Python function, translate that to Rust. It might just be the case that doesn't work because Python is just inherently different than Rust.
Interesting. Yeah. Tons of sub-problems there.
My mind is kind of expanding at this point in time because I am sort of realizing more and more that there are so many little sub-problems and also sub-tasks that one can kind of come up with in this space in a way. Is this also maybe the main motivator? Because when I look at the continue.dev website and like some of the blog posts and also I guess it's kind of like a manifesto of sorts, the amplified.dev thing folks wrote. The ability to customize it for yourself is a recurring theme in like some of the work that I do. Yes. Do. Is that also because you just see this need of this one size fits all, given all these like edge cases, it's just never going to be exactly right? Is that also kind of like the attitude that I would be hearing?
Yeah, definitely.
Here?
Right. It's not necessarily for you, like maybe that's out of reach to do it for yourself, but what about for your team or what about for your company? Right. Like maybe that is possible.
And
it really just comes down to like, I think about like how, yeah, I mean, I've interacted with probably thousands, maybe tens of thousands of engineers at this point, and I can tell you that they each have their own definition of great software, right? What is great code? Because it's not like an objective thing, right? So even if these models were really good, like I would guess that the suggestions they would give, right, if they're an average of the training data that they've seen, like probably doesn't match super well to the definition of great software. And like people building, a lot of software engineers are craftspeople, right? And they want to build something great. And so it's just the recognition that like we each have our own definition of what great means to us, and that like as a result, we're going to need systems that give suggestions that better fit to our definition of great, which is different than likely many other teams or many other engineers.
Yeah.
So on the topic of like, okay, I'm assuming, you know, continue to dev your company. So obviously you want to maybe have some software to sell to other companies. I can also imagine there's an interesting story there. Like, hey, you've got your internal way of doing things. Like, this is how we do services here. So it makes sense to sort of maybe aggregate that. I kind of wonder, do you know if any people doing this for open source projects? Because part of me is wondering, if I think about scikit-learn, right? That also has its own norms and ways of doing it and its own history and et cetera. And it's also a pretty big code base if you think about it. Like, there's Scython in there and a bunch of NumPy standards, et cetera. Have you also heard about open source developers maybe being interested in this? Because I can't imagine there are some of these bigger open source projects that might also make for good like use cases maybe. I don't know if you spoke.
Yeah, it's something I thought about. Like, because it's also like, we're at a stage where open source is very much in flux, or there's lots of questions, right, from people changing licenses to people,
right?
I mean, not forking in the way that is proper, right? Lots of kind of just different behaviors that we haven't seen, or at least that are new, or at least challenging. Maybe they're not new, maybe they've always been here. I shouldn't say necessarily they're new, but that are challenging.
There's things being tested, I think, exactly. Might be the politically correct way to phrase it. There's things being tested.
So, like, one big one is, like, the reason these large language models are so good at coding is because, like, they just went and took all of this Apache 2.0 MIT license, permissively licensed code, and, like, just used it to train these models, right? And when we licensed this code, we didn't necessarily know that, like, oh, Continue or Rasa or scikit-learn was going to be just ingested and used
for
these large language models. Oh, that was not part of the conception, right? And so I have a big worry that as a result of that, right, people are not going to be as willing to publicly share as much code, right, and publicly share projects and things like that. And so as a result, like, you could see a world where, like, open source decreases, right, where we have the reduction of open source in this movement. And so kind of and thinking in that line, it's like, well, what would it be to expand open source? Like, what if we reverse that? And the one that really comes to mind for me is we have this concept of development data. And so what development data is, it's the data about what happens in between Git commits. And so as I'm using a large language model, the interesting side effect of using one is that you're generating a lot of data about how you build software, right? So you're showing in some ways the step-by-step process, or some amount of the step-by-step process you're taking to complete a task. When you use, say, like the chat sidebar edit, you're revealing that. When you're pulling in context to be used, like, you're showing kind of what is the important relevant information. And then also as byproduct of using it, you're kind of showing kind of the why. Why did you take this step instead of that other step? And that is really rich data. And so I would love to see a future where scikit-learn, since they're building open source code, what if they went beyond just the commits that they're sharing at every time step, but showing what happens in between the Git commits to create that library, that project, right? And then making that data also open source, right? And if we get lots of great examples about how this open source project was created, right, that people could go and leverage that to train even better models. And so this would be like an expansion of open source.
The thinking that I'm hearing here is, oh, we're going to change this doc string, and having just the one big change, there's a lot of stuff in between, and that's stuff that we're currently not blogging in any way or form. But for the models that you're talking about, that is actually the golden nugget.
Yeah. I think objects are called, like, the ideal training data would be like the inner monologue in our heads, right? Which we can't capture now, probably for good measure we can't, but there's a lot of data that we could capture that would be really helpful for building better models. And so I think people would definitely want to have discussions about what licenses that would need and things like that. But I think open source projects would be a good place to get it started, right? You're already sharing a lot of your code. You're showing kind of how the code to be. What if you shared even more information about how the code came to be? And with Continue, we give you that data, it's more like that. It's not like we give it. We just don't take it from you, right? We let you just drop it on your local computer. If you're a team, you can take all of the data from your local computer and put it into a central place. And so,
I did not know that. So if, as I'm using continue.dev, there's like a log of actions that are happening, and that can be stored as a separate file to train
exactly.
on later.
So like every time you hit tab or don't hit tab, like that's recorded. Like here's like the context that was given to the model. Here's what the autocomplete model suggested. Here's what was ultimately suggested to the user. And then did they accept it or not, right? That is logged in a JSON lines file on your local computer by default. You can turn it off if you don't
that
like
isn't,
that, but by default, that's good.
No, it makes sense. But it's a nice default that at least you yourself have access to. And I can definitely imagine if you're in it with a group, then it can be up to the group to determine what to actually go ahead and do with it. But I do fundamentally agree. Like, I think part of the hard thing here is also when I'm coding, some of my actions, it's so intuitive at this point because I've been programming for so many years that if you were to ask me, I have to like really stop in my tracks to actually try and explain what I'm doing. Just because it's all like automated shortcuts and we're at that phase at the moment, right? But I do agree there's like a lot of the art of programming is actually lost there. Just the diff commits are not going to give you the full picture. That is definitely a good observation.
Exactly. And if we want these models to help us more and more, right, as we're coding, then I think just training on only the diff commits, right, is not going to get us there.
Yeah, and that's not even talking about the whole issue. I don't know if I told you this in our pre-call, but like there's
been this research. I think it was done by,
I forget who it was done by, but it was basically they downloaded all the Jupyter notebooks from GitHub and they checked, do the notebooks actually run? Like just that, but also do the notebook, the code in the cells in the notebook, do they actually produce the output that's saved in the JSON file? And also, and I think that was like 4%, like some ridiculously small number. Yeah. But being able to, that's actually kind of the thing that also kind of scares me. And to be honest, when I've been trying with LLMs, especially combined with scikit-learn, a lot of the big LLMs, they're focused on what would be a sensible default 10 years ago. Like we've learned a lot in the meantime, and all the old blog posts and the old books and the old, you know, notebooks on GitHub, they actually kind of have code you don't want to have in the training set to begin with. And right now, I don't have a way to control that. But that's sort of my biggest frustration personally. This part of it is that I'm not able to make a change, but the other part of it is that I'm so clearly able to articulate what the problem is. I think that's kind of my big sort of moment with these systems. There's no amount of prompting that can sort of fix that.
Yeah, and so there it's like, do you just not use them? Like these tools are useless, right? Or is there a world in which you can, out of the scikit-learn folks, like maybe donate your data, right, to be used and be like Anthropic, OpenAI, if you're gonna use training data about scikit-learn, use this stuff, right, that we've been creating. Or maybe even better is like, if the models get small enough and GPUs become available enough and the skills are kind of democratized enough, could you actually just train your own models or fine tune your own models or encourage people to use models that you've created with other people that do actually give you the defaults that you want for now, right? Like, I think it's possible to get there. It's just like, how do we get there is the open question to a point where models are giving us the suggestions that we want, right? And that are ideally as custom to us and our definition of great software as possible.
I'm kind of curious on this point. So there's a lot of stuff that could happen, but I do agree, like this is also the core of that blog post that you wrote. Like it's maybe time to start collecting this training data. Like it's the stuff between the commits that's missing and not going to try to hark everything in, but just if you as a group could do something with it, something good might come out of it. Imagine now, I suppose that, okay, we have some of that data. There's stuff that you could do. And we're also going to open up maybe APIs for people to really customize VS Code the way that they like. Like, what are some things you're maybe looking forward to? Like some things that make you kind of go like, that's not here yet, but you can, if we can dream a little bit, like these are things that will be kind of cool to have models for.
Yeah. The one that I think is most likely going to be the next one, or what I hope is the next one, is kind of multi-file refactoring, right? Where you can just edit a single section of code in a single file, but multiple sections in a single file and multiple sections across files, is because there's so much of repetitive stuff. I don't know if you ever use like Redux, right? You have to go change like 8 files in order to actually make a small change, right? It's like a lot of that stuff is repetitive boilerplate, like fluff stuff that like could be done, but the UI, UX, the models aren't quite there. Developers haven't really learned to use LLMs. Like, how do you review that? Do you really want to like a GitHub style like diffing where you're kind of alt reviewing? Like, that doesn't sound like a fun kind of feature where all we're doing is kind of reviewing PRs. And so I think there's more work to be done to actually get that. And then longer term, I'm quite as excited about like async workflows where there's a lot of things where I think the models could take over and doing some amount of tasks, right? Smaller ones to begin with, but increasingly larger ones where I ideally from my IDE, I can kick off like, hey, go solve this Jira ticket, right? Or this GitHub issue. And then I can imagine a world where there's like a Kanban board and I can click into it and I can see, okay, here's the 15 steps that the model took in order to do this. And like, I think in the early days, especially, it would probably go wrong at like step 7, and you ideally have a easy interface for being able to give feedback and be like, hey, you went wrong here, adjust your approach. And then you press play and it kind of continues and goes. And ideally at that point then doesn't make the wrong decision and gets all the way through the 15 steps to complete this task. And in the end, you're able to not only see the outputted code, but kind of the process that was taken to actually evolve. Which once again, then makes it so much more important that you have this development data, that you have the ability to understand how this particular organization builds software so that when it has those 15 steps it takes, it's trying to do them as close to the ones that you would do or your team would do as possible so that you end up with the ultimate result that is as close as possible to what you would have done yourself. So I'm quite excited kind of in the long run for those types of experiences.
Yeah, no, so I can definitely see that there's stuff to do there. One thing I wonder, and it's more of an anecdote, I was talking to at a person at a conference, and this conversation reminded me of that. Like, we were discussing these LLM tools, and we were reminiscing of the fact that, you know, we've been in industry for 10 years, so we were actually there when this stuff wasn't around yet. But imagine being a new graduate, right? Like, oh, I don't know what PyTest is, better ask an LLM. Like, you kind of get this knee-jerk reaction to always have to rely on the LLM. And there might be an interesting question there. Is there a risk that we might also lose something in that sense? Because one of the conclusions that I think I still have is that at the moment, I'm still very happy that I can program with an LLM. And I don't know for sure if I would like to live in a world where I really need one in order to be productive. I don't know if you've got a
Jeff
on this.
How people are learning is changing. I think that's a really great observation. I think people are generally learning with and through large language models at this point. Not everyone, but a lot of people. And so I think it is kind of similar to at one point we would go to the reference books, and then eventually, right, Google and Stack Overflow became a thing, and we started Googling and Stack Overflowing instead of getting our questions answered by looking at the reference book. And I think
Stack Overflow is kind of like artificial intelligence. It was kind of doing the LLM thing before it was actually an AI.
Exactly, right? So in that sense, right, like in the same behavior you're describing, that could impede learning. Large language models do impede learning if you're not actually attempting to learn, in the same way that you could have Googled and Stack Overflow to just tried everything and not thought either, right? And just been like, try this and then does that work or whatever? And so if you use them, right, in this way, like, yeah, it is going to, and many people might do that, right? And that is going to be problematic. But from the developers I've talked to that are genuinely interested in learning, they actually do that a couple of times or realize they're over-relying and then change their relationship to the tool and change their understanding of when to use it and evaluate how to use it. And then the other side, right, is like, it's really easy now for me to like be in a random code base and then like highlight a section of code and say, can you please explain this to me? Right. And previously I would just be like, oh, I don't know what's going on here, but if you give like you're wrong, right? And so if you use it for that, if you use it, like if you're kind of a more junior person, right, instead of having to wait, I remember how much time I would have to wait. Like, should I spend more time like banging my head against the wall or like message the senior engineer? Mm-hmm. And then once I do, I have to like wait for them to reply. And so to have like this tool that maybe doesn't give me the answer, but expands the possibilities that I would have even considered, right? Where I can go and be like, this is what I've learned so far. Give it to them. Like, what other ideas do you have? Like, that opens up so many possibilities for me to then go dig further and faster. And so I think the learning cycles will also accelerate. So you do have ways in which I think this impedes learning, gets in the way. And then there are ways in which I think it accelerates learning. And for me, it's also like, I think we're at a point in time where we'll see that it's kind of like how you were describing programming pre-LLMs was like back when everyone programmed in assembly, and how it will be after is like the higher level programming languages. And I don't know about you, but like, do you ever break out into assembly and program these days, right? Did you know something by not being able to do that? Probably, right? But do you really need to know to do that, right? Or how to do that or do that? Maybe not.
No, so definitely, I guess the change that I've noticed for me personally is before I could maybe argue that part of what I bring to the table as a programmer is I know syntax. Like, I can generate syntax for you. I know the syntax. I can do pandas, let's say. And that skill has become less valuable, I think, because of LLMs. But sort of the ability to reason about a system and the ability to debug, that has become more valuable now because you check these LLMs a bit more. But I think the main point that you're alluding to here is you have to be conscious about it and sort of do deliberate practice, if that makes sense. So if you're going to use an LLM and you don't understand something, that's the time to be deliberate. And that's not something the LLM will do for you. That's on you as a developer.
Exactly.
And if you do that right, then you're still going to read the docs and you're still going to ask a question to a person because something just seems confusing. And you're also going to be aware of the fact you can't trust an LLM blindly.
Exactly.
Like, but if you don't have those properties, then you're going to be in the world of hurt.
Like that's exactly. And my belief is like, you will end up being as good of a software engineer, right? And then as a result, like you won't get that job or you won't get that promotion. And ideally, right, the system will incentivize people who are great engineers, right? I don't know if it necessarily does that even today, but ideally, right, like that will work its way out. There's going to be growing pains. I think there'll be a learning curve and we'll have to adjust as a profession, but my hope is that it will be better. I'm optimistic that it will like the net, it'll be net positive.
The one thing the conclusion I'm sort of leaning towards now is you also have these people that don't take the effort to learn how a debugger works in an IDE, and that can be fine for a long time.
Just do print statements, you know, but there will be a moment when you need the debugger.
And like that is got, if you're touching serious systems, that debugger will actually save you. But you do need to take the effort and it requires a little bit of curiosity. But you're actually going to learn how to use the tools that you use. And it kind of, what I'm hearing, if I reflect on this talk, one thing that you're trying to be working for is that you as a developer can do even more in the IDE because we've got LLMs at your disposal, but we're not quite there yet that you can really, as a developer, change the stuff you like just so it works very well for you. And that's sort of the path that you're going to be sort of going towards.
Very much, yeah. We're kind of enabling people to build software in the way that they build software. With the help of the LLMs, right? Like you shouldn't have to adjust your approach to building software, your approach to coding to be able to accommodate LLMs, which is often the case today, right? Where it's giving you that scikit-learn suggestion that is not
how
it's today. So you're like, oh gosh, I want to use this system instead of fighting it over and over again, right? I need to just do it like we did it 10 years ago. We should live in a future where like you get to say, no, this is the way to do scikit-learn in the year 2024. And you should be able to make the system give you suggestions that are closer to that. And there are ways in which you can already do that today, but they're not enough, right? And so we need to give more tools, more configurability, more customizability to developers so that they can easily do this, right? And that's kind of the point that I wanted to bring up earlier that is now coming back to me, right? Is like, I don't think this is going to be possible if like we all have to do it from scratch. So like Google, Meta, Salesforce, like they're building their own custom AI code assistants within their organizations. They are tracking development data, right? From their built-in IDEs, and they're doing this. But I don't think that's going to be accessible to most of the rest of us, right? And so I think what needs to happen is an open ecosystem needs to emerge, right? Similar to DevOps, where there's some open source, some proprietary tools that you as the organization integrate. They have APIs, integrations, right? You connect them into, okay, this is how we want our DevOps system to work. This is how we want our custom system to work. And those things give you those kind of different levers for tuning and changing and customizing. But it's not you building everything from scratch. Because if you have to do that, it's probably too much work and too far from like kind of the business outcomes that you want to see. And so I think this works when the ecosystem emerges. And that's why a large part of why we're open source is so that others can come build on top of us and others can kind of participate in this open ecosystem and we can work together instead of every company trying to build their own AI code assistant to rule the world. What if like all of that energy and effort and money was put into an ecosystem where people were working together and solving the different sub problems of the much larger problem together, right? And I think it's just complex enough and the market's big enough that hopefully what ends up happening.
Yeah, and you can kind of see this world where there's like a Hugging Face kind of there's lots of data sets thing. And there's like some groups that sort of give data sets for the larger crew to use and you can pre-train models that you can fine to it yourself. And you kind of see ecosystems like that. Like I'm going to make like one final analogy, and that is that I'm kind of into these programmatic keyboards. Like I've got these keyboards that you can really program. And one thing I noticed is some of these keyboards that, you know, you can just press a button. But some software is so flexible that it detects the difference between a button press and a double click. And there's like these dials that you have on the keyboards. And there's like a giant community of like hackers and people sort of going about it. But the only way it works is because we have some standard parts. Like there's different switches that you can put in. There's different electronics, but there's also open source standards. And when as I hear this conversation, this pretty soon, like that vibe I have with these custom keyboards, we might start getting that in IDEs as well.
Yeah, my hope, right? And even beyond the IDE, right? But everything that I've talked about today, right? Like you were just mentioning fine-tuning models or filtering out data or different aspects of this system, right? Could be standardized. And if we do that, then those assumptions can be taken as given for anyone else who builds on the ecosystem, or they can rely that, you know what I mean? Okay, everyone's going to use Git, right? And they're going to
put it into like some kind of repo like thing, and that's going to go in GitHub or GitLab, right? And then, okay, I can build my CI pipeline that assumes everyone's going to be using Git and either GitLab, GitHub, or Bitbucket, right? And then that allows kind of that ecosystem to form because there's some amounts of standardization on the key part. In some cases, that's open source and like a standard that's driven by a foundation, right? In some cases, that's just more what is the default or most popular behavior, right? But getting us to relatively all aligned as much as possible on the parts that don't matter, that don't need to be custom, that don't need to be personalized, will be key in order to actually unlock that customization and that personalization in the long run.
Yeah. So like we're trying to give you a sensible default and then you could figure out what's the best practice for you. Yeah. Like kind of like that.
Cool. This was cool and interesting to see. Like what I like about the continue to dev attitude is you can mix and match your own open source models, but you can plug in your proprietary stuff too. And that really allows you to sort of figure out what works for you. And kind of on the theme of like, hey, you have to be conscious about the tools that you use. It does give you a lot of freedom. So if you're keen on sort of customizing the IDE, it does seem like continue to dev is a very good place to start looking. So that's definitely cool. And I'm also happy to hear that frustrations with chatbots led you here. A part of me just thinks that's just pretty funny. So thanks for being on. If people want to find you, learn more about you, I guess continue.dev is a place to be. And you folks also have a Discord and you're pretty active there. That's this place to be, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. Really a large community on the Discord. The GitHub is pretty hopping. If you have issues that you run into, if you try it out, it's inside of VS Code and JetBrains. So on the website, the first two big buttons are click to open that up. Once you open up the marketplace, it's install, and it's a pretty nice onboarding, easy experience. So go and play it. If you have feedback or run into problems, like you said, join the Discord, message me. I'm happy to kind of help you out and learn from your experience. And we're also on like Twitter and LinkedIn everywhere. We're just continued dev. So DEV after the word continue on all social media.
And if you want to have another introduction, the Amplified Dev Manifesto is also a pretty good read. It's just something I can recommend.
Definitely. We need to update it now. Cool. So it'll be coming for the year. And for 6 months in this world, like things change. So we wrote it originally in April and a new V2 is coming. Excited to share that.
Sweet. Then once again, thanks for joining and see you on the internet. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Sample Space, and thanks in particular for making it all the way till the end. I really hope you're enjoying these podcasts that we're making here over at Probable. If you're interested to see more, you can find the podcasts on your favorite podcast player, but you can also go to our YouTube channel. And if you're interested, you can also reach out to us on socials. You can find us on LinkedIn, but we also are getting more active on Blue Sky these days. And in particular, if you want to speak to me personally about maybe some guests I got to interview, you can also find me as well as many of my colleagues on our Discord. Go to discord.probable.ai. You'll find us there, and feel free to give us any feedback you might have. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and see you again next time.